My castaway this week is a singer and an actress. She remains in the public mind, however, not for what she is, but for what she represents, the age of the 60s and sex, drugs and rock and roll. The daughter of an Austrian baroness and an English army officer, she went to a convent school, but her waif-like beauty made her a natural attraction for the hedonistic pop culture, and she embarked on a life of promiscuity and drug addiction. She survived two suicide attempts and three marriages, and now she lives alone in Ireland, where she says, "People accept me as I am." She is Marianne Faithfull. I don't mean to imply that you've turned into some kind of nun, Marianne, but I mean, it does sound as if you live in a kind of retreat.
It is like that. It's got a big wall round it, what they call in Ireland a famine wall, because they were built in the famine. They were built to give people work, and there are the great walls that surround the 18th century estates, the great Anglo-Irish estates. I live on one of the last of these.
So this is a cottage on an estate?
Mine is a folly, actually. The original bit is an 18th century shell grotto cottage, where obviously they would go and have picnics and drinks and tea and all sorts of things probably went on there.
But you're surrounded, the whole thing is by this big wall.
It's 1,000 acres. It's surrounded by a wall, and at 8 o'clock the gates are locked.
You're shut in?
Not really. I have a key, of course. My best friends all have keys.
Why do you say that this phrase, "People accept me as I am"?
I don't know what it is about the Irish that I don't feel I have to put on an act. I think that might be what it is. They like me. I always like people who like me. Surprise, surprise.
And what's more, you're a granny now. You're Granny Faithfull.
I certainly am, yes. I'm going to see Oscar tonight.
How old is he?
He's nearly two.
So you live alone, as you say. Are you lonely?
No. I work hard, and it involves a lot of talking to people and a lot of meeting people and a lot of being out. So for me, coming home to Shell Cottage and to Ireland is a wonderful relief.
But you've said in one interview, anyway, that you think you've driven away all prospective partners and husbands.
No, I don't mean that.
But if a prospective partner or husband came along, you'd
well, it wouldn't
be willing to
be easy for them. I've made myself about as unavailable as you can be, but it's not impossible, she said, hopefully. Somebody really wanted to get through, they could.
The gate would open and the key would come out.
That's a real sleeping beauty thing.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, I chose it because when people hear it, they will know where they are. They are in the 60s. I knew Jimmy. He was a wonderful man. I really wanted to have "Hey Joe" by Jimi Hendrix on my desert island so I could think about him.
Jimi Hendrix and "Hey Joe." Jimi Hendrix, whom you knew, Marianne Faithfull, but he never seduced you, you never seduced him. Is that right?
I tried, and I wish I'd gone. It's one of my only regrets in my life.
What about Bob Dylan? I thought you resisted him,
too.
Oh,
I did, yes. Don't quite regret that as much as I regret not being seduced by Jimi Hendrix.
Gene Pitney, you were seduced by.
Oh, yeah.
Had an affair with, and plenty of others, including three of the Rolling Stones. Does it all seem crazy now when you look back across that? Or do you know even now how you fell into it all?
Well, I fell into it all because I was incredibly beautiful, I think.
Did you know you were incredibly beautiful?
Not really, not like that. No, it's only with long distance and sort of perspective now when I look at pictures of how I look. Now I can understand it. It isn't unusual. I've seen very, very pretty girls that obviously didn't know how pretty they were yet. It's something about being very young, I think.
But it was also, in your case, to do with looking like you were supposed to look then. Mm. I mean, as it happened, you know, long legs, blonde hair, blue eyes, pouty lips. Mm. It was exactly how the face of the 60s was supposed to be, and you had it.
Mm. It was the dream. I'm glad. I mean, it got me into a lot of trouble. I wouldn't exchange a lot of it, if I could. I really wouldn't. The only bit I would leave out, if I could, of course I can't, is the drugs.
Because you're often represented in all of it as a victim.
Oh, no.
You weren't, were you?
No. People are often trying to do that, sort of, to try and get me off my own hook. But I prefer, if I have to be on the hook, I'll be on it. You know, I'd rather take responsibility for it than not.
Tell me about the record, though, As Tears Go By, written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
Mm.
How did that come about? How did you, I mean, did you know you could sing?
Oh, yes. I had a most beautiful soprano voice. I was having singing lessons. I was going to go to the Royal Academy of Music. I was going to be an opera singer.
But how did you come to record that number in that way?
I was discovered or seen at a party by Andrew Oldham, who was the manager of the Rolling Stones. And it was literally, I walked into the room and everybody stopped talking. And I was discovered.
And, so it was simply a matter of finding the right song for you to sing, to record?
Yeah. I recorded it, it came out, nothing happened. And I remember feeling sort of intense relief because I had a vague idea that if this was a hit, all hell would break loose. This all went on in my summer holidays. So I was just thinking I'd got away with it and I would go back to school in September and get on with my A-levels. And then in October, it took off. And that was that.
Tell me about your next record.
I remember when I was little, growing up, there was a couple of Brecht Weil songs on 78. I like to think they were my mother's. I think they might have been. I think they might have been a German label. And I put this in because of my parents. It's a Kurt Weill song. It's Berlin im Licht.
Und zum Spazieren gehen genügt das Sonnenlicht. Doch die Stadt Berlin zu sehen genügt die Sonne nicht. Das ist kein lauschiges Plätzchen. Das ist ne ziemliche Stadt. Damit man da alles gut sehen kann. Da braucht man schon einige Watt.
Kurt Weill's Berlin im Licht, performed by H.K. Gruber and the Ensemble Moderne. You're into Kurt Weill these days, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, very much so. It's been something I've been working on for a long time now. The first time I recorded a Kurt Weill song was for Hal Wilner on a compilation, a tribute to Kurt Weill called Lost in the Stars. And I did The Ballad of the Soldier's Wife. And I immediately, I mean, as I was doing it, I felt like I'd come home, that this was the music I really wanted to do.
Mm. Now, you were characterised as the little middle-class innocent, but your background...
Well, I was. It was true.
Well, it was more unusual than that, your background.
Well, I do have an interesting background, but still, I was a little, nice little middle-class English girl. I really was.
Well, yes, but not all nice little middle-class English girls have fathers who are related to sexologists.
No.
Intent
on
curing frigidity.
And mothers who are related to masochists.
Well, exactly.
Quite.
They were an odd couple, your parents.
They were. They were. But I do think that I wouldn't be me if I hadn't had those parents. And I'm very glad that I am like I am.
And the name, of course, is real, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
People always say, you know, when did she change her name?
But I know.
It's a beautiful name.
Well, I'm very grateful to my dad for her, for being Glyn Faithful.
And Mum was an Austrian baroness.
Yes, she was a dancer. She was a dancer in Berlin before the war. That's one of the reasons I chose Berlin im Licht. Her name was Eva Sachamazoch. And her great-uncle, my great-great-uncle, was Leopold Sachamazoch, who gave his name to masochism and who wrote the famous book Venus in Pelts, which is Venus in Furs.
That presaged something, didn't it?
Well, I don't know. It's an awfully silly book. It's not half as fascinating as the Marquis de Sade.
Now, your mother, as I say, was a baroness who expected to be treated like a lady. Did she bring you up to be expected to be treated like a princess?
Mm-hmm. She did. And actually, I don't think it was such a bad thing. I now know, if I have to, I really can give somebody such a killer look they nearly shrivel up. And I learnt that from Eva.
But in the end, you wanted to escape from her. You wanted to leave Reading and go off to this scene in London that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a grander ambition than any other teenager in the 60s would have had?
No,
did yours run
I was
any deeper?
Just wanted to be part of my own generation. I wanted to be in on it.
But you escaped, as you've said, since to a kind of nightmare. That's what it turned out to be in the end, isn't it?
That because of drugs. If it hadn't been for drugs, it wouldn't have been such a nightmare. That's all it was, I think.
Record number three.
Well, when I was 12 or 13, I remember going with my mother in Reading to see Gigi, and it made a very deep impression on me. But for years, it was almost like a sort of... like I thought that's exactly how life was going to be and what my life in particular would be like. And I used it as a sort of life role model. And that's why I chose The Night They Invented Champagne, because I still believe in all that.
The night they invented champagne, as plain as it can be, they thought of you and me. The night they invented champagne, they absolutely knew that all we had to do was fly to the sky on champagne and shout to everyone in sight that since the world began, no woman or a man has ever been as happy as we are tonight.
The night they invented champagne, from Lerner and Lowe's musical Gigi, with Amanda Waring as Gigi and Geoffrey Burridge as Gaston. Do you recall the first time you met Mick Jagger?
Oh, yes. It was at the party where I was discovered by Andrew Oldham, which was a launching party of a record that Andrew had produced for a girl called Adrienne Poster. And I guess all the Stones were there. I don't remember them all. But I do remember seeing Mick having a row with Chrissie Shrimpton.
But you said since that the first time you really gave him any thought, you decided he was a cheeky little yob.
He wasn't my type.
Wasn't he?
No.
How did he come to be your type then?
With time. And I've obviously fell in love with him.
Keith Richards was more your type, yes?
I don't know. I like very sort of serious, clever... Keith Richards probably was my type, yes. You're right, I have to admit.
Was Mick Jagger clever? Is Mick Jagger
terribly
clever?
Of course. I mean, you know, Mick was somebody with time, as you got to know him, as I got to know him, I found out he wasn't at all what he seemed. Much more interesting.
You said also before now that he certainly wasn't what he seemed. He was apparently very fastidious. He didn't like the bohemian life.
No, I've never understood how this happened, that people thought he was so sort of dirty and slobby, and further from the truth you couldn't get.
But he fell in love with you first, didn't he? I mean, that was why the affair began.
I think I'm a bit like that, you know. If somebody doesn't fall in love with me and make me notice that, I wouldn't notice. But if they get my attention, then I will respond.
You've also said since that he was quite mean. You were...
No, he's not really mean. He was one of the most generous people I've ever known in my life. I think he likes to be known as mean. I think that a lot of rich people do, but he's not really mean.
It was you who was extravagant, maybe that's what it was.
Well, I was beyond, yes, I was very extravagant. This could irritate anybody.
You enjoyed spending his money.
And I was very good at it too. And he enjoyed me spending his money.
He saved your life once, of course,
he did.
Didn't he?
Mm.
He got you to the hospital in time when you'd OD'd.
Well, if he hadn't been there, yeah, I wouldn't have made it.
Mm. But you've also implied that he was possibly bisexual. That
well,
somehow you and Anita Pallenberg, who was Brian Jones' girlfriend, that you were kind of used by the Stones in order to kind of relate with each other.
I don't know. I was bisexual. I am assuming, really, that this crosses over into other people. I would say there's definitely a bisexual current in Mick Jagger. I have no clue whether it's ever been acted on or not. I'm not saying it as this guy is a bisexual faggot.
You don't think it was just a case of kind of liberated youth just trying out everything on offer? I mean, as you say, you tried out.
It certainly was in my case. I mean, I found out in the end that I really wasn't bisexual, and I made a decision.
But
I think probably that was the same with Mick. We were so young, so rich, so beautiful, we could do anything.
And you wanted to break the rules. Yeah.
We certainly, oh yes, very much so.
Next record.
Ah, yes. One of my greatest all-time favourites. I couldn't live without it. Bob Dylan. Highway 61 Revisited.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, all on Highway 61.
Bob Dylan on Highway 61 Revisited. The day, Marianne Faithfull, your reputation was made, or I suppose more accurately...
Destroyed,
ruined, yeah. Was in February 1967. Mm. There was a drugs raid on Keith Richards' country house. You were dressed in nothing but a fur rug, and Mick and Keith ended up spending time in jail. Now, you believe that that was a set-up, don't you? It was the work of MI5, you think?
There are two actual examples of this in the 60s. One is the drug bust at Redlands, Keith Richards' country house, and the other one is the Oz trial. I would love to see the details of this. There must be records of all these things. It all came out in America. If they were doing it in the States, they were doing it here.
But why do you believe they wanted to do it?
It's a way of discrediting. I think that...
They were
frightened. The authorities took much more seriously than we knew the whole youth culture and what we stood for to young people. And I think they were determined to maintain the status quo and not let this happen. And this drug bust was an attempt at that.
So the drugs were planted, you believe?
No, they didn't have to plant the drugs. What happened was that this man turned up from America with all this stuff. It was so simple. I mean, you didn't have to plant anything. We were, oh, good, let's all go to Redlands and take this stuff and see how it is. And off we went. Robert and Christopher and Mick and Keith and me and Michael Cooper and Mohammed, who was Christopher's Moroccan servant.
So you were the only woman?
Mm. And we went out in a van to go and visit wonderful things, and everywhere we went was closed. In the end, we went to the beach, and we had a wonderful time sort of running around the beach like children. It was a very... There was something very young about it, really.
It was an escapade.
It was. And never thinking that all this dark stuff was coming down on us, we got back to Redlands, very tired and dirty and covered in twigs and moss and bits of sand and shells and pebbles and all sorts of things. And so I went and had a bath, and I hadn't brought... Everyone else was changing into ever more fabulous costumes, because that's part of... That was what it was like those times. And I had forgotten to bring a costume. But on the bed was a huge, vast fur rug. It really could have, as Keith said in the trial, it could have covered 10 women. And I picked this up and put it on, and it looked wonderful, of course. I really did look like Venus in furs in that. I went downstairs, and we were just chilling out, as they say. And at this point, 24 West Wittering Constabulary walked in.
The stories that followed after that, of course, were very lurid and explicit. Some true, some presumably not so true.
Well, you're alluding to the Mars bar story, which is not true, which... I don't know how to put it. Yes, it's always upset me and angered me, this.
So it still worries you now, does it, all these years on?
I've gotten over it a bit. That story really took away my good name as a woman. It's my feminine self that was hurt by that. And that's what angered me about it, that Mick and Keith came out of this even more glamorous and wonderful and sort of outlawed. I was destroyed by it. I had not understood the power of the authorities at all. Now I know.
Next record.
I really wanted to give you a picture of what it was like, and this really is a picture of our life and how it felt. Shell Cottage is so isolated. It's very like my desert island. I can sit there at 4 a.m. and play Dear Mr. Fantasy as loud as possible, and I have great speakers, and it's wonderful.
Dear Mr. Fantasy from Traffic. You and Mick, Marianne, stayed together for a couple of years after that. Your attitude from 67 on seems to have been that you might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, doesn't it?
I started getting these horrible letters that I was still only 19, I think, or 20, after the bust at Redlands, that I took very much to heart. I am like that. I still take things to heart. But if I get a bad review, I really take it to heart.
Those letters also came because, in fact, you were married and you did have a young baby, didn't you? I think, didn't people react to you saying you were a bad mother because you seemed to be promiscuous because you were into drugs and so on?
I was promiscuous. I don't think that makes you a bad mother, though.
But isn't that what the hate mail said?
No, it was much more poetic than that. it was pure evil. It was, you are evil. I don't know if there was any real tangible reason. I don't think it was just coming out of that I was an allegedly bad mother, that I was the mistress of one of the Rolling Stones. It was just, you are a bad person and the sooner you're dead, the better.
And in the end, of course, you lost custody of your son, didn't you?
Yes, well, that was all connected with leaving Mick. While I was with Mick, I had protection. The minute I walked out of that protection, I was completely vulnerable.
And you walked out of there onto the streets, really, didn't you?
No, I walked out of there with Nicholas and Tassie and a Persian carpet to my mother's.
Who was Tassie?
Tassie was Nicholas's dog. My first husband's family and my first husband, John, obviously did what they believed to be the right thing, and I accept that.
What, and taking custody of Nicholas?
Yes. They didn't do this because they thought I was a bad person. They weren't like that. But anyway, these things are sort of technical questions now because it's all a long time ago. And they're good people, you know. They did what they believed to be the best thing. I think they were wrong. I think they were wrong for me and Nicholas.
Was that why, in the end, you ended up on the streets in Soho? You mean you became...
I lost hope, yeah. There didn't seem to be much point in anything once that was done.
But how did you survive out there? I mean, was it not very dangerous?
Yes, it must have been very dangerous, but... And I wouldn't recommend it.
But did nobody come to find you? Did nobody care about you?
No. I didn't want anybody to come and find me. Occasionally people would show up. Brian Gyson, the painter, would come and find me occasionally. Kenneth Anger would come and find me occasionally and feed me and let me go. But it took a particular kind of respect for me to be able to let me be, and I needed that. I didn't do this to get attention or to have people come and find me. I literally didn't want anyone to know where I was. I wanted to be left alone. I believe there's something that looks after fools like me in that situation, really. Of course, it was different then. It's even a million times more dangerous now. I was very lucky, and the people were very kind to me, you know, and that deeply impressed me, because they didn't know me. They didn't know my name. They didn't know anything about me. But I found out in that 2 years that I found out about the basic goodness of human beings, and I really stand by that. When they've got nothing, they will give the little bit they have to another human being. I think that's amazing.
Next record.
Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones.
Shelter by the Rolling Stones. Do you ever see them these days?
Not very often, but they were recording Voodoo Lounge in Dublin about 2 years ago now, I think. And I was invited down to the studio, and I went down and saw everybody. It was great.
Must have been very strange. I mean, you have all that history with them. Where do you begin?
It seems to mean anything, you know. I think I must see them all together, like once every 10 years, literally every decade. And I walk in, and there's Charlie, and there's Keith, and it's just like nothing has ever. It's no big deal.
But do you think they have any sense of guilt about you? Because at the end of the day, your suffering was much greater than theirs, wasn't
it? I don't
it?
Know about that. I don't
well,
know
publicly
about that.
It was.
Yes, but that doesn't mean anything. Obviously, to be the Rolling Stones, to be the greatest rock and roll band in the world, you have to be very, very tough. And I rather admire that, really.
And you have to use people up and spit them out,
I don't know. First of all, I don't wish to be seen as a victim. I don't wish anybody to feel guilt about me, thank you. I will feel my own guilt. And, that, you know, I don't want that. I'm very fond of Keith. I'm very fond of Ronnie. I adore Charlie. The only one I have a bit of a problem with, and it's obvious when we do meet, which is so rarely, is Mick. Yes, there's a lot of blood under the bridge there, and it's awkward and difficult. But Jerry's always very nice and helps a lot.
It was a good 20 years before you finally kicked the drugs, though, wasn't it?
Well, I wasn't on drugs for the next 20 years. I finally came off drugs properly, finally, 1985. And I didn't go back on after that. But I would have long periods off, and then I would use again. If I hadn't had long periods off, I wouldn't even be here now. And, of course, eventually, eventually comes to the point where you... They call it between a rock and a hard place, where you have to get off or die.
But your success with Broken English, your record Broken English, really did something for you, didn't it?
It did a lot for me, and I didn't even expect that. I never expect these great bonuses life throws me. I'm amazed when they happen. The book has done the same thing. It's sort of given me pride in myself, a faith in myself again, which I didn't. I needed it. There's still days of low self-esteem. These things are never over. Anyone who's ever been addicted to hard drugs, you can never feel safe again.
Record number 7.
Oh, this one. I thought about it a lot. I wanted to play for you something that really represented the 70s for me. And there was a lot of things I loved in the 70s. I did like punk. But in the end, I've realised that the bit of the 70s I really hold with me and meant more to me than anything has been Jamaican music and reggae. It's a great spiritual charge, this music. And so, from that bit of my life, I wanted to play Small Axe, Bob Marley.
Small Axe by Bob Marley and the Wailers. So these days, Marianne Faithfull, you've obviously got a hold on yourself. You've quite a controlled life, actually.
Well, I think it's because I work quite hard. I find that if I'm doing a lot, I really do have to go to bed early. I really do have to take care of myself because I want to look as nice as possible. It's probably vanity, really.
Well, why not?
Why not?
You're still not 50. What do you want from life? What would you like to have happen?
More. I want more.
Now, that got you into trouble last time.
Well, I haven't really changed. I want something else. I am writing another book, and I really like doing that. I enjoy it very much.
And you're very close to your father these days.
Yes.
Because you weren't in your early life. He paid you a great compliment, I read. He said he's delighted now that you're such a nice woman. Mm.
He wrote me a letter. I had it framed. It's a wonderful letter. I mean, my father was always there. It was me that was running, you know, and I was running from everybody who loved me, from my mother, my father, my family, everybody, my son, everybody, as far as I could get. It was true Brechtian alienation, I'm afraid.
So these days you've got a family. I mean, you know, your son...
Carol, my daughter-in-law, she's great.
Your grandson. All of a sudden, Marianne Faithfull is part of a family.
I'm part of the whole thing. That's what I never used to feel. I am part of my family, but I'm just... I feel like I'm part of the human race.
And if we take you away from all of it and we put you in the middle of a desert island, you'll be absolutely fine because you're one of life's great survivors.
I think I will, actually, yes. I think I wouldn't mind it, as long as it didn't go on too long.
Tell me about record number 8.
It's something, again, I play very loud after midnight at the Shell Cottage. It's Orfeo, Monteverdi. It's the story of the god of music, Orpheus, and his great love, Eurydice, and he has to go down to hell to get her. And the king of the underworld says, you can have her back, and no one has ever, ever escaped the underworld, ever. But you mustn't look back to see if she's coming with you. And he does. And as he looks back to see her, he loses her. And to me, this whole story is everything. That's what I've been through. I've been there. I know that one. I thought my dad would like this. I want to play this for my dad.
Caso Acerbo from Monteverdi's Orfeo, performed by the Monteverdi Choir, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. Now, if you could only take one of those 8 records, Marianne.
It's very hard. I think, as I'm going to a desert island, I will take the Bob Marley.
Small axe.
Yeah, it'll be useful.
What about a book?
Yeah, I thought about it a lot. I decided I would take Robinson Crusoe.
For inspiration.
For inspiration, for tips, for philosophical well-being. It's all in there. It's a wonderful book. I've always loved it.
And because there's a Man Friday.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. The first thing is that I will find is a Man Friday. I hope.
There's not one there, I promise. What about your luxury?
I want to take pen and paper to write, but... The pen has to be... There's a special pen you can get at Asprey's, which is a pen, but it has a magnifying glass on the end. Can I have that?
Extravagant to the end, really.
Yes.
Well, I suppose so. If you define it. And lots of paper. What are you going to write?
I'm going to write what it's like to be on a desert island with Bob Marley record.
We look forward to reading it. Marianne Faithfull, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.